My name is Scott Stoddard, and I'm with the University of California Cooperative Extension in out of Merced, California, which is kind of smack dab in the middle of the state, and it's where we produce all of our sweet potatoes. Let me start this for myself, keep myself on time. I think, though, if you're the moderator, you get to go on for as long as you want, right? Isn't that the... Okay, so let me get going on this thing. So, yeah, little be known to a lot of people is that we produce a lot of sweet potatoes in California, roughly 750 million pounds or so of the product. And so when it comes to irrigation, we drip irrigate them now predominantly. But this actually has not been occurring for very long. In fact, you can go back in and look at production guidelines from only 1998. And at that time, in 1998, we were still predominantly a furrow irrigated system. And if you look at our 2012 guideline, more than now, I would say 95, maybe even, we might even be pushing 99% now. It's very rare to see a furrow irrigated sweet potato field now. In fact, I should go and take a picture of one next time I see one because it'll be a historical photo, really, is what they are. They're so rare to see. So this is where we are. Just kind of give you a little bit of a backdrop. I mentioned we're upwards of 750 million pounds or so. And what I'm basically showing here is that we've had tremendous growth in our production of sweet potatoes since about 1998, as you can see from the orange chart on this graph. The red arrow is basically just kind of showing you about the time when drip irrigation started to be widely adopted by the industry. So that's total production. And so to kind of look a little bit closer at our yields per acre at the same time we adopted this drip irrigation, it is one of the factors that has allowed us to continue to increase our yields. And in fact, the two lines here basically is just showing one is a long-term sort of going back for about since 1950 annual increase in production of about 500 pounds per year. If you go back a little bit closer to when drip irrigation was actually introduced, now we're upwards of, say, maybe 750 pounds per acre per year on average. So I probably need to recalculate this because we've kind of seemed to maybe have hit a plateau in the last. But nonetheless, it is an important part of our production. It gives the growers a lot more yield, a lot more uniform yield. So this is kind of what happened. You know, we use surface application, and a direct result of this technology has been improved uniformity and yields, so not only increased yields, but as well as you don't get all with a furrow irrigated field, you would have had a huge production close to the ditch where you were getting a lot more water at the tail end of the ditch in the old days where you would have essentially been deficit irrigated. You would have not had a lot of production, and so the nice thing about the drip is improved uniformity across the field. So the early work that was done with drip irrigation included things like real practical stuff, as you can imagine, implementation of this new technology. How do we get this stuff to work? So, you know, what kind of tape is best and how much filtration do we need to do? And can we use it to do pest management or fertilizer? And what do we do there? And basically, so a lot of real practical information was started to be developed in, say, like some of the first trials were actually done in the early 90s. But there was nothing, however, on the amount or timing of water application. Okay? So what I'm trying to show you here is that when we first started doing this work, we approached it kind of like how the tomato guys did and everybody else did. We buried it, as you can see right here. The line is going in. Big problems in sweet potatoes. And the roots would grow right into the tape. Literally, I mean, some of these drip lines, they'd clog halfway through the season. You'd pull them up, and it looked like a snake had just swallowed a big rat or something. There would actually be a big root in the middle of that tape, right, clogging it up. And so now what we've done is we can't bury it anymore because of root intrusion problems. We have to go with a surface drip down the side right there, so you see that. So that was some of the very practical work that was done very early on. Okay. However, so what I got into, this was actually, when I started into this, it was actually before we had our big drought, but I was kind of thinking about the long lines of, hey, when you're in California, it's not if the next drought's going to occur, it's when it's going to occur. We always know we're going to have years where it's very, so I just wanted to generate some, if I could, some basic information on, where do we maximize yield? What water? It maximizes yield. But even really maybe more importantly is, if we need to deficit irrigate, can we do that? And what's the effect if we deficit irrigate? So, set up some on-farm trials starting in 2010 and continued through 2013, so 4 years. Used surface drip tape, randomized complete block design. Each of the plots were 2 rows by 100 feet typically. So what I did is I fully irrigated the plants for the first 4 weeks before I installed or I implemented any of my treatments. And that's just to kind of get the roots going. So initially it was just, okay, let's irrigate them just like a grower would be. And then I built a six-port manifold. I used battery-operated timers. I had inline water meters. And I used both soil moisture sensors. I used both Decagon and Watermark soil sensors set at those at various depths to try to measure soil moisture. So here are my treatments that I used to initially kind of get a look at this. So I now remember, it's more of a thinking about what would happen in the case you had to go to deficit irrigation. So that the emphasis you can see here is on the 40%, 60% of ETC, 80 and on up. And then I had one in there that I sort of had extra room, so I kind of threw in what this thing called, I just did 100% ET, so no crop coefficient. That was actually thrown in because I started trying to figure out, are there any published crop coefficients for sweet potatoes at the time. There's very limited data on crop coefficients, so that was kind of thrown in there as, do we even need to worry about the crop coefficient? And then this was also, there was just the grower irrigation, so to speak. It really wasn't a treatment, but I was in a grower's field, so I was able to measure what his yield, for example, what he was doing. Okay, so here is how I calculated ETC, which is, as you just saw from the previous presentation, about the ETO times the KC, and this is I was calculating in acre inches per day. And so what I needed to do was, because I had these battery-operated timers, I needed to be able to tell these things to click on for a certain number of hours per day and irrigate for that amount of time. And so a lot of times when you see calculations like this in a drip-irrigated system, you have to account for things like distribution, a uniformity of the system, which in drip-irrigated fields is often point like 90% or something. You also have to have a leaching fraction. Now, I didn't have to do the distribution uniformity in my particular situation because I directly measured what my what these drip lines were measuring. So that is already sort of taken into the account of what the drip line was delivering. Okay, so I didn't have to assume that this is supposed to deliver 22 gallons per minute per 100 feet, something like that, and then divide that by 0.9 in order to account for distribution uniformity. I just went with exactly what, and you will see there that I've got some of this drip tape was 102, 117, there's a 92 gallons per, in this case, measured gallons per hour per treatment. So that was already in my equation, okay? And I'd go through these calculations by a weekly away, and I would come up with some actual hours that I needed to actually irrigate these plots, okay? The ET came from our California Irrigation Management database system that we have set up in the state. It came from the Merced weather station. So this, I just go in, you just can download this data, it's available online. So that's where I got that. So that'll, in the end, that'll generate, this was from 2013, but just showing this for reference, what it kind of looked like. Here are the KC values that I used. Based on some stuff I found on doing some research, starts at 0.4, goes up to 1.15, comes back down to 0.65. Actually, so this matches with what the growers do. The growers normally go into a deficit irrigation at the end of the season. So this is not an obscure thing for them to kind of deal with or comprehend. Okay, that's kind of what it looked like. So there's the well and the pump. Here's my manifold. Went into these lines that then go out to the field. And then from there, the drip lines going off to each one of my treatments. Okay, so results. Here's my average weekly water use going on upwards acre inches, as high as like 2.5 acre inches per week, depending on the treatment. Notice that there's a kind of a spike here at the beginning that occurs because when you initially plant, even though the KC is very small, we initially start off by giving we have to sub the water. Basically, it's very sandy soil. This is a subbing of the water issue. There's other spikes that occur in here because you get things like gophers chewing on the lines, which causes a lot of water to go out in the system and things. So you get some wiggling in the data. But in general, you can see some nice separation eventually occurs. And overall total applied water range from about 12, 13 inches over the course of these 4 years on up to about 33 inches of water. So those were the ranges of the total water applied based on my treatments. Now, I'm not going to get into this part very much other than to say this, is that I did take soil moisture measurements. I found my soil moisture measurements to be erratic, full of I had a lot of problems, and that what my watermarks and my decagons did not correlate very well together. So they would, you know, the watermarks are basically telling me, hey, you're like way deficit irrigating, and the decagons are saying, no, you're all right, you know, this kind of a thing. So I was kind of going more by what the plant looks like. Okay. Really fastish kind of show you this because all these graphs, they kind of look the same. So here's like 2010. You get a stepwise progression, significant yield increase for every irrigation treatment on up to the 100%. Dun, 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 just like that. And then there wasn't a yield benefit beyond that. So that was 2010. The flash to 2011, same thing. We get 40, 60, 80, 100. And then beyond 100% of my KC, it didn't offer any benefit. Okay, and then on this one, for some reason, when I transferred this over, I lost my letters, but the story is exactly the same thing. Significant yield increase as we go up to 100, and then nothing beyond that. So I can take this data, and what I did is I made a relative yield chart over here, relative yield, where I established my 100% as my 100% relative yield mark, and then I varied the other treatments relative to that, and you can see what basically occurred here as compared to applied water. So a significant, you know, quadratic response, add more water up to about 100% of ETC plot yields, and this has occurred at around 29 to 30 inches of water is what this is telling me. So maximum plot yields, crop yields over a 4 year time occurred at around 29 to 30 inches of water, relative yields. However, that's not the only story. When it comes to sweet potatoes, you get small roots, you get medium, you get small roots, you get number one roots are what they're called, and you get these jumbo sized roots. What this did with all these dots and like, how can you make any regression out of that? I mean, I realize that it looks like a scattered diagram. There's no regression. There's no correlation going on in your thing, but that's because you can't see the colors going on there. And the fact that all these dots down here are jumbos and these in the middle, they're mediums and the other ones are number ones. And what this is that the impact was far greater on jumbo big roots than on the other sizes. And so I need to wrap this up, but that's important because, so here's what I found out. 100% relative yield, total marketable yield occurred at around 29 to 30 inches of applied water. Total market yield declined 20% with a 22 inches of water. So in other words, about 75% of ETC. Okay, so a 20% yield reduction at that. Jumbo yield declined more than the other size categories. And what that means is this. If you impose a deficit irrigation of say like about the 75% of ET, you get a total marketable yield loss of about 20%. But because you're affecting the jumbos more than you are affecting the number ones, and because jumbos are worth less than number ones, the economic loss of this system is 16%. And that's what this chart is basically saying, is that because it's the total marketable yield loss, the actual pounds produced has declined 20%, your dollars that you receive have only declined 16%. So at least you got that going for you. If you're a grower and you need to impose deficit irrigation, try to save some water. Keep that in mind about what are the economic impacts, you know, roughly about what might happen with if you start restricting water to this crop. At least it doesn't hurt you. It's not as bad as it could be, I guess. Okay, so I'm finished up with just a few seconds left to take maybe a question, if there are any. Oh boy, okay, Steve, you raise your hand first.
How sensitive are sweet potatoes to water?
So the question is, how sensitive are they to water quality? They are a somewhat of a salt-sensitive crop, definitely not as salt-sensitive as, say, some of the crops like strawberries. This was good water quality, what I was using right here. And it was fertigated with, but you can see the impacts of, say, like an EC of 2 or what would give you expected 10% yield decline, and potentially problems in harvest. I mean, in storage as well. Okay, one other question before I. They were I haven't looked at them for a while. They're the three-pronged ones that measure the temperature, also the soil pore EC, and the other one it wasn't actually the sensors that I had a problem with. It was the data loggers I had a problem with. The data loggers could not handle our field conditions very well. The batteries they got too hot, basically, and you'd lose contact with the batteries. You get erroneous data and produce. It was kind of driving me crazy. All right, that's it for me, and so we need to call up our next speaker.